From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up 5 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, military families are still adjusting to multiple deployments. We'll hear what families go through when a loved one is deployed. And thousands of Iraqi refugees are heading to this country. But is the federal government helping or hindering resettlement efforts?
Anyone looking at the program would say, well, clearly what's been set up here is to keep people out, not to bring people in. The system is so convoluted.
Also, anti-war protests as art in Los Angeles and a review of new music inspired by a bus trip in Africa.
Simply going to Africa was a big deal for the dozen or so members of Aphrodisia. A chance to absorb the music that inspires them in its natural setting.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. Next week marks the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It isn't clear when or how Operation Iraqi Freedom will end, but it's safe to say the war hasn't exactly gone as the Bush administration predicted it would. 429 Californians have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined, including two this past week. The cost in dollars spent and lives disrupted both here and in the Persian Gulf has been high. And so we're devoting the top of our show to the war, with stories about military families here in California, refugees from Iraq, and artists who oppose war. We begin with two California women being honored for their work helping military families prepare for deployment. Barbara Drawn coordinates Operation Ready Families for the Air National Guard's 144th Fighter Wing in Fresno. I asked her what families need to know before a loved one ships out to Iraq or Afghanistan.
For one thing, they need to know that there are other people that have gone through or are going through or will go through the same types of scenarios that they may have. Sometimes it's just knowing, is there somebody out there that I can call upon if my water heater goes out, if something occurs with my vehicle breaking down, if I become ill, and who's going to come alongside and help me with my children? If I end up having an electrical problem at the house and I need to make a repair on it, what do I do? Who do I go? How do I handle those things?
Suzanne Moles volunteers with that Operation Ready Families group in Fresno. Her husband, Stephen, is on active duty but isn't deployed at the moment.
I think that the volunteers have a lot of impact, and especially when deployments are going on, because I'm part of the California state training team, and we work with a lot of Army units where there's a lot of deployments going on. So I'm kind of very conscious of what is happening to these families and how we kind of work as volunteers in that capacity to help them understand what's going on and to face, you know, some of the things that they're going to face and trying to make them a little bit self-sufficient.
What's the toughest part of having a loved one deployed, do you think?
I would think probably the loneliness. Your life has been disrupted. And the unknown, I think they're probably the main things, you know, they probably think of more than anything.
This has been a particularly tough week for the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Several soldiers from California were killed. Give us a sense of what a family goes through when you hear the news that there have been deaths over there.
I guess it's sorrow for the loss of life. And probably it's something that you wouldn't believe in the beginning. You know, you can prepare yourself for so much. You think you can, but it's just like, you know, if maybe your parent dies, you think, okay, they're getting old, I'll be prepared for this. But when it happens, you don't react the way that you thought you were going to. So you really don't know until you really face it yourself.
Do you think that in a way you have to be part of a military family to fully appreciate what a family goes through when a loved one is deployed?
I think military families, they're a community of their own. It's just a different world. We seem to be able to relate to each other. I would just like to tell you just a little story. I went to the National Convention a family readiness conference a couple of years ago, and there was this really great speaker that we had, and at that point in time what they were doing, and it was in respect of those who'd died in these conflicts, and it was on boots, and they took this display around the United States, and it was just the boots, their military boots, and it had the name. And one of the things that happened to me, and it was kind of a little tearjerker thing, but one of the things that happened to me at that time was that I respected my husband's boots much more. A funny story, but a very, very deep story, because I was always falling over my husband's boots, you see, and thinking, why couldn't you move them? But now I pick them up very gently and put them in the right place because I always want him to be in the boots.
Mm. Well, Suzanne Moles, thank you very much. Good luck to you and your husband, Stephen, and all the families that you work with.
Thank you very much.
Suzanne Moles is a volunteer with Operation Ready Families for the Air National Guard's 144th Fighter Wing in Fresno. The war is also disrupting life for many Iraqi families. More than 2 million Iraqis have fled their homeland since the war began. The U.S. has pledged to resettle 12,000 Iraqi refugees this year, but only 2,000 have actually arrived. One advocacy group in San Jose is pushing the U.S. to do more to help Iraqi refugees with ties to Silicon Valley. Juan Ha has the story of one Iraqi who left his homeland in fear.
A year and a half ago, Hussein al-Massawi was a marked man. He didn't know who was after him, but he knew they wanted him dead. Why? Because he cooperated with the Americans, working as a driver for the United Nations in Baghdad.
Five of my friends who worked at the United Nations were attacked. One of them was driving his car, and he was shot. Third one was kidnapped, and we found his body burned. Of course, I always felt I was going to be the next one.
Al-Massawi shuttled between the homes of relatives to avoid capture. One December evening in 2006, armed men came looking for him. He wasn't home, but his brother-in-law was, so the men shot and killed him.
I don't know who's do that. Yeah, the militias, maybe.
That's when al-Massawi decided he had to flee Iraq. He left behind his wife and two young daughters. He escaped to Jordan and applied for resettlement to the United States. Al-Massawi now shares a two-bedroom apartment in San Jose with another Iraqi refugee.
I want to study and work in care. This is my country now.
The two roommates arrived last August, part of a first wave of Iraqis the United States agreed to accept as refugees, some 2,000 of them. Nearly a third have ended up in California, coming to communities like San Jose and San Diego, where earlier Iraqi refugees resettled after the first Gulf War. Catholic Charities is one of the groups that helped them start new lives with job training and English classes.
Last week, on our own, everyone read these news articles. Hussein, are you comfortable reading? Do you want to read?
Yes. Many women are in having.
Al-Massawi attends classes at this Catholic Charities office in San Jose several times a week. The group found him an apartment and got him a job at a gas station. But he says he feels his life is on hold until he's reunited with his family.
I'm safe here. I'm everything okay here. But my family and my daughter is sick there. What can I do?
He tears up as he recalls how his wife and two daughters fled to Syria a few months ago. They now share a cramped two-room apartment with 11 others. Along with thousands of other displaced Iraqis, they've applied for resettlement, hoping to come to the U.S. But the wait list is long, and refugee advocates say the U.S. is not moving quickly enough to process refugees.
It's hard for me to know that we aren't doing much to reunify families. What we're really doing is separating families.
Ellen Dumanil is with Catholic Charities of Santa Clara County. She recently led a delegation of refugee advocates to Syria and Jordan. The group met with more than 50 refugees who have relatives in Silicon Valley, including al-Massawi's family. She says the refugee program is inefficient and overly bureaucratic.
Anyone looking at the program would say, well, clearly what's been set up here is to keep people out, not to bring people in. The system is so convoluted.
Last year, the United Nations referred some 16,000 Iraqis to the U.S. government for resettlement, people the U.N. says can never safely go back to Iraq. but only 1 in 5 have actually made it to the U.S. Many aid groups are skeptical the U.S. will meet its target of bringing in 12,000 this year. George Rupp is president of International Rescue Committee, one of the largest resettlement agencies in the world.
The United States needs to step up to the plate to admit more of these refugees to this country. A few countries, Sweden and Denmark in particular, have done far more proportionately than the United States has.
Critics say there are long waits to get interviews with the UN, and then there's a lengthy and complicated process of getting security clearance from the Department of Homeland Security and the State Department.
Since September 11th, the security vetting of refugees into the U.S. has increased, and necessarily so.
James Foley leads the State Department's program for Iraqi refugees. He acknowledges the U.S. wasn't prepared to deal with the exodus from Iraq, but says the government is committed to stepping up efforts.
I'm not satisfied with the progress, but I am satisfied that we now have in place the mechanisms to do a lot better and to reach our goals, which are fairly ambitious.
He says more than 4,000 Iraqi refugees have already been approved for resettlement, and they'll arrive in the U.S. in coming months. Meanwhile, Hussein al-Massawi has been told it will be at least a year and a half or more before there's a chance he'll see his family again. Al-Massawi spends a lot of time in his kitchen. Cooking is a welcome distraction. He says he was full of optimism when he first arrived in California, but the adjustment has been a lot harder than he expected. He says his wavy hair turned from black to silver because of the stress of the last year. He was so distraught when he learned of the long wait for his family that he quit his job, and now he's on welfare. The highlight of his week are phone calls back home. This is a special call. It's al-Massawi's 43rd birthday. He breaks into a wide smile as his 3-year-old daughter and his wife sing birthday greetings. The family bought a chocolate cake and lit candles. They ate his slice as he listened over the phone. He says his only birthday wish is to share peace with his family. The Catholic Charities delegation presented the case of al-Massawi's family and others from Silicon Valley to the UN Refugee Commission. They've yet to receive a response. But they and other California groups are preparing for the arrival of hundreds of new Iraqi refugees in the coming months. For the California Report, I'm Juan Ha.
War often provokes a creative response from artists, writers, musicians, and filmmakers. A new exhibit in Southern California includes work by artists critical of the Bush administration's war policies. The show focuses broadly on the concept of political dissent and draws comparisons between the massive student movement of the late 1960s and today's youth activism. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez has that story.
At the height of the Vietnam War, National Guardsmen shot and killed 4 students during a protest on the campus of Ohio's Kent State University. Linda Like was a graduate student in the university's art department.
May 4th, 1970. Yeah, it's a date that I think will stay in everyone's mind from Kent State. It had a profound effect, the whole shooting, the aftermath, the way that people felt, I think, became a kind of a disillusionment with the government.
The shootings moved college students and artists nationwide to voice their dissent. The song Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young captured the mood of the time. At Kent State, Linda Like used her skills to create 3 works of art.
I wanted to sort of pay homage to the dead students. And because I'm a printmaker, and I think printmaking is a very viable means of protest.
2 of those prints are on display at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. The exhibit is called Dissent, 1968 and Now.
This is Jeffrey Miller sort of dying on concrete. He was in a parking lot about 300 feet away from the guardsman when he was shot in the head.
The prints use pop art techniques, simplified shapes, saturated colors, to capture a turning point in the 1960s student movement. Like, who's an art professor at LA's Occidental College, says student activism isn't dead.
The dissent that happened from the 70s was really a mass revolution of young people in the U.S. And I think dissent today is very articulated in a more nuanced way.
Most of the 39 works of art in the Dissent exhibit explore issues other than the current war in Iraq. Co-curator Eric Benjamins says he wanted to explore the different shades of dissent among art school students today.
We have, you know, the more blatant political works such as, you know, The Lesser of Three Evils by this great artist Kenji Ohara from Cal State Long Beach, which is quite blatant in its presentation of a baby George Bush in a crib with an American flag. And we have, you know, more personal work that relates to identity and sexuality and gender.
One artist who's delving into cultural identity is 20-year-old UCLA art student Chris Leem. His five black and white photos challenge the idea of nationality and nation building. Leem was inspired by stories of his relatives in Indonesia after World War II.
In this photograph, there are two bamboo spears over a batik backdrop, and this one's called Great Uncle. I found out that he had been held in an internment camp, and he was tortured, and he was killed he was stabbed repeatedly through the torso with bamboo spears.
22-year-old University of Southern California art student Liza Epps uses humor to voice her dissent. She created a print that's roughly 3 feet by 4 feet. It's a magazine cover with a smiling Laura Bush holding a bottle that says 9/11 spray, terrorist cleanser, bomb shelter disinfectant, kills 99% of terrorists on contact.
It is funny to see Laura Bush advertising a terrorist cleanser, you know, and trying to clean out her bomb shelter and take it, you know, Martha Stewart her way into the next decade.
The protest art of 40 years ago never died out, says UCLA art historian Paul Von Blum. It just ebbs and flows. In the decades following Vietnam, African American and Latino artists carried the mantle of protest art. Artists who cut their teeth as part of the Black Panther movement and the United Farm Workers began showing their artwork in galleries and museums. The Loyola Marymount University exhibit, Von Blum says, signals a new wave of the art of dissent.
I really have seen a wonderful development of people trying to combine their artwork with a deeper critique of society. Now, I think that there are reasons for that. We are in a war that seems endless after 5 years, and we have a looming economic recession.
Artists Liza Epps and Chris Leem are encouraged that their 20-something peers are engaging in dissent by going to the polls in record numbers. Changing the system from within, they say, is a smarter and safer strategy than violent revolution. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
You know the old expression, if they can put a man on the moon, why can't they fill in the blank? Well, now the federal agency that did send men to the moon is teaming up with medical researchers in Southern California. Their goal, breakthrough treatments for brain cancer, using structures so small they're made on the molecular level. KPCC's Brooke Binkowski has more on the promise of nanotechnology.
Brain cancer is a long odds kind of disease. Survival prospects are slim, and research into effective treatments is limited. But new help is on the horizon. City of Hope is a cancer research and treatment center in northeast LA County that's recently formed a partnership with a neighbor, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL. Dr. Binam Badi, who runs the hospital's neurosurgery and brain tumor program, says it's hard to treat brain diseases because of the blood-brain barrier, the thin membrane that separates the brain from the rest of the body. It keeps bad chemicals from getting into the brain, but it also makes it difficult to use drugs to treat illness there.
So what I think is happening is that we're seeing a lot of patients with other cancers that show good response to tumor otherwise in the body, but they end up having more tumors in the brain.
This problem, and his background studying macrophages, cells that surround and attack intruders in the body, drew him to nanotechnology, specifically nanotubes, which are molecule-sized cylinders. Those tubes can be used to carry small amounts of drugs and essentially hitch a ride with the macrophages through the blood-brain barrier and into the brain. That would help doctors target tumors there.
The nanotube study began as I learned about the technology at JPL. And because these macrophages have this ability to basically take up debris, they can also take up the nanotubes. So the idea came that perhaps if you can modify these nanotubes, one can probably use them to deliver chemicals.
In the lab at JPL, researchers heat raw materials in small white ovens that look appropriately space age. When they heat the carbon with silicon, the carbon curls itself into tubes. Nanotubes look unimpressive, like black dust. But the lab's Dr. Harish Manohara says they form a substance that's stronger than steel, more durable than diamonds, conducts heat better than any other known material, and the body doesn't reject it. Quite the opposite.
It turns out that statistically, simple terms, cancer-fighting cells are preferentially intaking these things, these tubes, than the tumor cells. So basically what you want is to juice up the cancer-fighting cells so that, you know, they wake up from their sleep and start fighting cancer cells. So that's the basic idea behind the targeted treatment of brain tumors.
Menahara's group has conducted research with nanotubes for some time. But until recently, he didn't see them as medically practical. Now, he's changed his mind.
It started with that 60s movie. You remember that movie? Where they go inside the body to treat, basically, an anomaly in the body. So where do I see the nanotechnology going? Actually, it's very promising, to tell you the truth.
Last year, Manohara and other scientists published a research paper with City of Hope Hospital showing how mouse brain cells react to the carbon tubes. Since then, many more research centers, including the University of Southern California and UCLA, have begun their own studies on nanotechnology as cancer treatment. Researchers hope to start clinical trials with human volunteers soon. They say if all goes well, these atom-sized disease fighters may be available to patients within 5 years. For the California Report, I'm Brooke Binkowski in Los Angeles.
Finally today, one benefit of California's cultural diversity is that it exposes all of us to the traditions, styles, and tastes of a whole lot of countries. For the Bay Area band Aphrodisia, inspiration is found in the African funk and rock sounds known as Afrobeat. Their latest release chronicles their journey to Africa and their unexpected pilgrimage to honor an Afrobeat legend. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman says the Lagos by Bus musical expedition is well worth taking.
Simply going to Africa was a big deal for the dozen or so members of Aphrodisia, a chance to absorb the music that inspires them in its natural setting, as well as to showcase their distinctive approach to most demanding audiences. But a chance encounter in Ghana with a legend of Afrobeat, a man named Orlando Julius, turned it into something even more amazing. Julius, a part-time Oakland resident, who has led a vibrant Bay Area African music scene for years, said he could arrange for the group to visit and perform at the New Africa Shrine, a compound run by the family of the late Afrobeat pioneer Fela Kuti in Lagos, Nigeria. Now all they had to do was get there, a several-day road trip traversing two other countries on the way.
Bus driver, stop. Pay your fare. Bus driver, stop.
That's the song Bus Driver, one of the highlights of Lagos by Bus, the band's new album recounting the Ghana to Nigeria trek with tuneful and rhythmic joy. The trip to Africa fulfilled a dream held by Aphrodisia founder and bassist Ezra Gale. He'd started the band with jam sessions in a shack behind his Mission District home several years ago and heard plenty of stories of the continent from co-founding singer Lara Makovic, who had spent a year working and studying in Ghana and Zimbabwe in the mid-90s. Befriending Ghana band the African Showboys at a California festival led to a formal invitation to visit. But Lagos by Bus is not an audio documentary, rather a chronicle of a meeting of cultures, a melding of cultures. Holy Ghost Invasion manages that remarkably. It's preacher-like phrases taken from signs and slogans the band saw posted along the streets of Lagos, but put in a setting that's very much San Francisco Impressionism.
All you have is all you need. All you have is all you need. All you have is all you need. You don't have to suffer.
That kind of approach helps separate Aphrodisia from others in what seems a proliferation of young American Afrobeat bands these days. Brooklyn's Antibalas and Detroit's Nomo, among others, pay varying shades of homage to Fela and other West and Central African legends. The roiling rhythms, blaring horns, and vocal sparring by Makovich and co-singer Maya Dorn clearly draw inspiration from the strong presence of African music in the Bay Area. But Aphrodisia has no interest in being a tribute or copy, adding original art twists, even when doing such songs as Ochim Me, based on a Yoruban song praising the spirit of fresh water. Gail has said he'd like nothing more than to take the group back to Africa, though the logistics and economics of such a venture with a large group present serious problems. Even if they can't return, Lagos by Bus is clear proof that they had the trip of a lifetime. And us? Hey, Aphrodisia went to Ghana and Nigeria, and all we got was some great music.
Steve Hockman covers pop music for the LA Times, and he writes the global music column Around the World for Spinner.com. He reviewed Lagos by Bus by Aphrodisia. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Rory Gallagher. Seal Muller is the technical producer, with engineering help from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, and Leanne Lucetta. The producers are Victoria Malione and Susie Racho. Pat Flynn edited our story on Iraqi refugees. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.